Welcome to Bringing Sickle Cell Disease to Life, an American Society of Hematology podcast. I am your host, Dr. Wally Smith, the Florence Neal Cooper Smith Professor of Sickle Cell Disease at Virginia Commonwealth University. In this series, you're going to hear interviews conducted with individuals living with sickle cell disease, leading researchers in the space, providers, and other stakeholders. Join us to learn more about this exciting area of research and find out what you can do to make a difference in the lives of persons living with sickle cell disease.
The most exciting part of what I do, is being able to cure patients. But another really exciting part is when I see something happening to patients that's not where it should be, I can actually take it back to the lab, answer the questions in the lab, either, you know, in the petri dish in the lab directly. We also have mouse models, and we can work it out in the lab and then bring it back to the patients. So it's called translational research. We're able to translate what we learn in the lab to the patients to make things better for the patient.
Dr. Courtney Fitzhugh explained some of her research to us in an earlier episode of this podcast. Today, we're going to talk about translational research, which is taking the laboratory research into the clinic. Let's start, though, with Kyle Smith, as he tells us about acute chest syndrome, a serious problem seen in patients with sickle cell disease. So one of these days you get an acute chest syndrome. What is that?
Yeah, so basically it is a crisis within the lungs. You know, your lungs fill up with a mucus, unfortunately, that is very, that causes a lot of pain and discomfort and makes it very, very hard to breathe. And it is no joke. It takes everything out of you, you know, like all of the energy. If we think about our lungs just in general, you know, as someone who doesn't have sickle cell, right? What do our lungs do? They do a lot for us, right? You know, like we are constantly using them. They provide oxygen throughout our whole system, right? So it's super important. So imagine, you know, you having some type of impediment on your lungs that is just making it hard for you to breathe. Okay, so now it's hard for you to breathe. So what does that mean? That means that you're not able to, like, you know, walk maybe as intentional as you could if you were able to breathe at full capacity. You're not able to think as clearly as you would if you, you know, had as much oxygen going to your brain. You're not able to articulate yourself, you know, as best as possible. You know, it just impacts everything. It's so pervasive, right? It just goes everywhere. So
kind of a vicious cycle, huh? No oxygen means you don't think well. It means your cells sickle more. And when your cells sickle more, you hurt more.
You hurt more. And the kicker is that in order to feel better, you have to take deep breaths, right? You gotta try to expand your lungs even more. So you have to create pain in order to hopefully get out of that pain, right? So it's in order to get out of that vicious circle, you know, you have to kind of create your own vicious circle, right? So yeah, I'm so fortunate that I have been able to, like, have as many acute chests as I've had in the past, and just to get through that, because, you know, those are some of the worst complications from sickle cell that I've ever experienced.
Dr. Solomon Ofori-Akwa does research on acute chest syndrome. He spoke with us from his office at the Vascular Medicine Institute at the University of Pittsburgh. I see from your impressive bio that you have gone deep into the sickle cell biome and understand quite well the vascular abnormalities in sickle cell disease. So for the benefit of our listeners, give them a flavor of the tone and tenor of your research and the big ideas that you're pursuing.
Sure, thank you. So my primary focus in the last maybe 10 years has been on acute chest syndrome. And I'm a basic and translational investigator. So most of the research tools I've used, really the central one for several years, was the transgenic sickle cell mouse model. Even though it's a mouse, it does have several of the characteristics of the human disease. And so I started this way back when I was at Emory University. There was one particular question I wanted to ask, which is highly clinically relevant. And that was, how does acute chest syndrome become triggered? You know, how does a sickle cell patient who is complaining of pain in his or her back or leg and gets admitted to hospital with acute vaso-occlusive crisis, how is it that that patient then in a day or two may develop an acute chest syndrome that potentially could be fatal? And so we had to think of a way that we can model that in an animal, right, in a mouse. And so the work that I think I'm most well known for was to try to figure out a way that we could trigger a process similar to what we see in humans that potentially may cause acute chest syndrome in mice, so that we'll be able to understand the biological processes involved. And so one of the things that happens in a lot of sickle cell patients who get ACS, particularly the ones who get very severe ACS, is that at the time of presentation in hospital, they tend to have a very massive drop in hemoglobin. And so we figure that that massive drop in hemoglobin may have something to do with an acute intravascular hemolysis. And so to model that idea, right, to model the idea that acute intravascular hemolysis in the setting of vaso-occlusion may contribute to the development of acute chest syndrome, we basically took a sickle cell mouse and we infused into that mouse one of the byproducts of acute intravascular hemolysis, being basically heme, not hemoglobin. Hemoglobin, we all know hemoglobin, but within hemoglobin is a small chemical called heme. And so when patients undergo intravascular hemolysis, that heme can basically dislodge from hemoglobin and potentially cause tissue injury. So to mimic that scenario, we took a sickle cell mouse and then we infused purified heme. And lo and behold, this mouse developed the classical symptoms of acute chest syndrome. We were able to monitor the lung function of the mouse and show that they actually had very severe hypoxemia. And then further studies show that, in fact, these mice developed edema in the lung. So the model we developed basically showed a scenario whereby increasing the concentration of free heme in the circulation, we're able to recapitulate or rather model not only the biological, physiological, and clinical, but also the pathological features of acute chest syndrome in a mouse model. And so that, to me, was very gratifying.
Let me see if I understand what you're saying on a level that the audience can grasp it. So This thing you're talking about, heme, it's inside of the hemoglobin, right? It's one of those parts of hemoglobin.
Correct.
Hemoglobin is like a group of protein balls, and inside the protein balls is this thing that carries the oxygen that's called heme, right? That's what you're telling me about?
That's correct. That is correct.
That thing has iron in it, does it not? The heme, does it have
iron? It does have iron in the center.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that's toxic to your body when that leaks out, I guess. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, it's toxic to your body when it gets out, and there is a defense mechanism. We have another protein in our plasma called hemopexin. And so because it's toxic, this protein called hemopexin will normally bind the heme and transport it to the liver for it to be degraded. And so, you know, if you don't have sickle cell disease, you have very large amount of this hemopexin. But in sickle cell patients, because of the hemolysis being so continuous and being so intense, they essentially ran out of hemopexin. And so when there's an acute hemolysis and you have, you know, an excess amount of heme that somebody who doesn't have sickle cell disease will be able to cope with, a sickle cell patient and by extension, a sickle cell mouse is unable to cope with that large bolus release amount of heme. And so that heme then is free to basically go and cause havoc. And that's what we were able to demonstrate, that that happens actually in the sickle cell mouse. And then we've done some genetic studies in humans. Of course, the experiment that I described, we can only do in a mouse model, right? But then the knowledge we got from that allowed us to then backtrack and see, okay, a couple of questions. If a sickle cell patient has low amount of hemopexin, are they at risk of acute chest syndrome? And the answer is yes. If a sickle cell patient has the capacity to degrade the heme using another enzyme called hemoxygenase 1, are they more protected from acute chest syndrome? And the answer to that question is yes. That was a study we published with my good friend, Michael Dubon, where we showed that sickle cell children who have a better capacity to degrade heme actually have a lower risk of acute chest syndrome.
So let me make an analogy. So I'm thinking of the trash in cities, and I'm thinking of garbage trucks. And you've described that sickle cell patients don't have enough garbage trucks. They're so busy running around taking out the trash.
They run out of garbage trucks.
And then the trash continues to pile up. And that trash is what the heme is. And it's toxic. And it smells. And it stinks. And the streets get full of it. And people get disease from that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You got it right. Right. Absolutely. Great analogy.
That's bad.
Yes. So that is what my major contribution to the field. So we've always known that the, you know, sickle cell patients running out of garbage truck is a problem. We've always known that then leads to a lot of trash not being picked up. But what we did in my lab was to connect that dot, connect the dot between the excess trash and a specific clinical complication. We're able to demonstrate that if you don't pick up this trash, in other words, heme, it can trigger acute chest syndrome.
Yeah. And it does kill people, unfortunately, if we're not careful. Is this something for which we could develop a drug? Are you trying to develop drugs to pick up the trash?
Yes. Yes. And so, again, because this paradigm of the excess trash was well known, there have been attempts to see how it can be picked up. As I mentioned, the truck is hemopexin. Hemopexin is a plasma protein. So those are two proteins that one currently being used for a clinical trial, and the other we are developing a recombinant to try to see whether that will work. Now, the trash causes the lung injury, activating a receptor called TLR4. And there are drugs that can block TLR4, which potentially can also be developed to neutralize the danger that heme causes.
I see. Some of that was broken up by the internet reception, but I think I understood what you're saying is that there's a company in England that's developing, I guess you could call it an artificial hemopexin or real hemopexin to try to pick up the trash better.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're developing something that's engineered, I guess, an engineered approach for a drug to try to pick up the trash as well. And each one of them might prevent acute chest syndrome. And I guess we're waiting to see if this works in mice. How does this work? You start in mice and see if you can prevent it in mice?
It actually works in mice. And so the question is, you know, our major publication on this was in the Journal of Clinical Investigations in 2013. And there we show that it works in mice. What we are working on now, what we showed worked in mice was the hemopexin, which is undergoing clinical trials. What we showed most recently at a 2019 ASH meeting was that the recombinant that we're developing also works in mice. And so now the question is whether these proteins can be developed in large scale to produce in amounts that can be used in humans. And then you have to do the clinical trials in humans to see whether it's actually efficacious. Because, you know, more often than not, what works in mice doesn't necessarily work in humans.
I'm going to mark this date down so I can say, I knew you when. When you get this drug and it makes it to the market and you're a rich man, I'm going to mark this date down. That is really exciting. This is attractive to me, and I am old enough to not be able to go and repeat anything that you've just done or maybe be around when all this finishes out. But it has got to be enormously attractive to our listeners today, the people we're trying to attract into the field of sickle cell disease. Tell me what it's been like being a basic scientist, thinking about fixing something that ultimately can be put into the hands of doctors who will treat the patients. And tell the audience how important it is to have people like Solomon Ofori-Akwa.
That's a great question. I'll take that in two parts. You know, one of the things that I do, obviously, I'm a minority investigator, and I'm conscious of that. One way to answer the question about the hunger to do something that is translatable, this actually came to me when I was in Pittsburgh. It started at Emory. You know, at Emory, I was in the Department of Pediatrics. It was a five-story building, and I was the only investigator of color working on the bench. I had lots of colleagues who were hematology physicians, but they were all physicians. There wasn't a single African-American bench scientist. It was clear to me that was a little weird because, you know, I was in Atlanta and I thought, I would have had a few more, you know, colleagues working on the bench who were African-Americans. So that was when I first thought of that. That's interesting. And then when I went to Pittsburgh, again, you know, I'm part of a very large research group. And there again, I was the only African-American who was working on the bench. And the thing that struck me was that as much as we've made a lot of strides to have physicians, you know, doctors who are African-Americans, on the basic and the discovery side, we didn't have many. And, you know, if you think about the use of a drug, ultimately, people who discover drugs have some say in how it is utilized. And so one of the things I've done in encouraging young African-Americans to, of course, it's wonderful to have doctors and physicians, but it's equally important that we increase the number of underrepresented minorities who are doing basic discovery research. And so whereas I do the science, I also am an advocate to get more African-Americans in the discovery side, because physicians, obviously, with all due respect, they are great physicians, but you give the drugs that have been discovered by at the bench. And sometimes not, you know, having the lack of diversity in the innovations, right? Those who are innovators, those who discover the drug, the lack of diversity there, I think, sometimes has hampered the way we're able to make these drugs more accessible to a wider audience. That's one of my motivating sort of, it's a little voice in my head.
Yeah.
Tells me, you gotta keep doing this, because there are not many of you like this. So you gotta stay in this field.
Now, wouldn't it be great if some of the things Dr. Ofori Akwa discovered helped out individuals living with sickle cell disease, like Kyle Smith, to prevent or to treat acute chest syndrome? And there are so many other areas of research where we need young people to get involved in translational research, especially those from underrepresented groups. There are resources for people who are considering such a career or a career in hematology. They're on the ASH website. They're in the show notes. Go look at them. So there it is, the end of season two of this podcast. Stay tuned for next season when we learn about the members of the team that are critical to caring for individuals living with sickle cell disease. Maybe one of those members sounds like you. Thank you for listening as we help bring sickle cell disease to life.